Thanks for tuning in to Public Radio KDNK. This is the Living Permaculture Show. I'm your host, Stephanie Sison. Jerome is in Hawaii, so he will not be joining us today. But boy, what a guest we have for you. Colorado native, professor, groundbreaking researcher, and author of a book I can't put down right now called Nourishment: What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. Fred Provenza, welcome to the Living Permaculture Show.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure, certainly. A friend of mine recently gave me a copy of your book, and it's such an amazing read. So far, I have gotten about halfway through it, just full of research on animal nutrition related to forage in a way that's super thorough, and it covers so many different topics from soil biology, plant chemistry, animal behavior, human development, all these things. It's difficult to summarize your book and your work very quickly, and we'll inevitably only scratch the surface during this short 26-minute show. But lucky for our listeners who live in the area, because you're going to be coming to speak at the Rifle Ag Expo on February 1st. So we're really excited. And for all those listeners out there who this is just enough of a teaser for, get down there to listen to Fred talk. So I'm curious what you'll be speaking about at the Ag Expo next week, or how long is the talk? What are you going to be able to get into?
I think it's an hour-long talk, and I think I'm going to talk quite a lot about our linkages with landscapes, how we've broken those linkages over time, and you know, the value of reconnecting with landscapes. From soil through plants and plant diversity. As you know from reading Nourishment, I'm a real fan of diverse plant communities for what they, you know, I think often of plants as turning soil into communities, because they create the habitat for all of the creatures below ground and above ground, including domestic animals that we rely on as a source of food in part. And so those linkages from soil to plant, through animals, through human beings, and right on through to climate and what's happening with climate. And that's what I think I'll focus on. I'm still working on it and thinking about what I will cover over there, actually. Well, but I'm really looking forward. I always enjoy to come back to Colorado. My home has never left my home. My heart has never left Colorado. You know, I was born and raised there, raised in the mountains, and on a ranch there. I was on a ranch there for 7 years, and I went to school studying wildlife biology at Colorado State University. And so just my heart is really there in Colorado. Not saying that Montana isn't a nice place to live.
You've lived in some nice places.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And so what brought you to write this book? You have so much history in the university and research in animal nutrition, and all of this wonderful story as you start the book with was it the goats or the sheep that you were foraging on the Blackbrush?
Yes, it was the goat. That was my introduction to working with domestic goats and this shrub called blackbrush down in southern Utah, and that was a real eye opener for me. You know, my dream research position back in those early days, 50 years ago, would have been to study goats, but it would have been mountain goats, and it would have been in the high mountains of Colorado. It wouldn't have been domestic goats down in the deserts of southern Utah. But I learned so much from the plants and their behavior. You know, when the goats browsed them, they created new twigs that were high in these chemical defenses, so the animals didn't want to eat them. And then watching how the goats behaved and what they did, learned so much. And so the book starts there because that, from a research standpoint, that's where things started for me with my wife's help. wildlife zoos help. But so we worked, and that went in such a flash. That was 35 years of, you know, from being a graduate student through a faculty member through retirement. And when we retired, we debated whether to move to Colorado or to Montana. But our parents were old, and we decided that we would be better off to move to Colorado to try to help them in their last year. So we moved to, as I say in the book, the Backwoods, for people familiar with Colorado, they know where South Park is. And we were living south end of South Park, 12 miles in on graveled roads. And it was beautiful. We were at 9,500 feet in the transition between aspen and conifer and the parklands of South Park. And it was just a great time for me to reflect over the years from, you know, being born and raised there and then through a career, how quickly it had gone. And, you know, I thought so much about how when I was a young kid, everything was just amazing to me. I loved animals, especially any kind of wild creature, fish, birds, insects, frogs. It didn't matter. I was enthralled by those, just enthralled. And when we got there to the Backwoods, I was no longer working at the university, obviously, and it was just really a nice time to kind of become a child again in that sense, and then to try to put a little of that flavor into the book of nourishment, not just write it as a purely scientific kind of thing, but to try to get a little bit of life into the book, you know, make it a little bit. So the first three sections of the book are a lot about the research we did to try to understand animal behavior and, as you say, many other facets of things, and just to kind of recount that and then link it with humans. We were really studying processes, you know, how do things work? And so you might say, well, what's a goat got in common with a human being or a sheep? But it's amazing how much
a lot
gets to processes. A lot, huh? Because, you know, we start learning about foods in utero when we're in mom's womb, cues in mother's milk are cues to what's food, mother as a model. And you start to realize all these processes and these metabolically driven feedbacks and all, you can match it right up with what we humans do. So the first three sections of the book are really a lot about that and about how all of that works. I, in a way, wrote the book, though, more for the last two sections than the first three. The last two are very reflective about the limits of what we know and can probably know, and then about the dynamism of life in this universe, life living by consuming itself at all levels, from galaxies with black holes that are consuming every galaxy in this universe, right on through to goats eating blackbrush. Everything lives by consuming everything else. So the book gets quite reflective in those last two sections, and I really wanted to write about that. I was working, though, with a publishing company originally, or with an agent. And when I showed him the first manuscript, reflecting what you said, he said, well, this really, the way we write books nowadays, this is 20 books, not one book. And so he was trying, and you're laughing, you probably appreciate that. And
absolutely.
I don't know if I should have done it the way I did, but I wanted to write it as one book rather than 20 books and to just try to put in the different sections. So,
well, I think it comes across, it comes across really well, and I didn't get time to read thoroughly through the second half, but I did poke around quite a bit, and it comes across so clearly that as a person who spent his life in research, then there's this understanding of how limited research studies are also. So you have this section where you're talking about cinnamon and insulin levels, and you...
Right.
I love that. This, what happens to my insulin levels if I'm aware of this research and if I believe that cinnamon is beneficial? So how does that even fit in, or how could anyone research and study in a numerical way and understand that. It's so individual. It's fascinating.
Yes, that's that fourth section of the book, Grappling with Uncertainty, and really coming to appreciate that life in its essence is uncertainty. And then the power of what we believe. It's as you were saying with the cinnamon example and many, many others, the one chapter in that section on how powerful and in a positive way the power of what we believe for, you know, for better or worse, the so-called placebo and nocebo kind of effects are so powerful. And you come to realize that in our health and well-being and healing, just huge, huge effects. It's was really interesting to me reading about all of that and then being able to write about that as well.
We've been working with some different things at the ranch. So we, at our ranch, it's a biodynamic ranch, and we have lots of diversity of animal life, plant life, lots of different people working in those different sections. And I head up more of the medicinal herb grow. So we grow 3 acres of medicinal herbs in this very biodiverse system. And I come from more of a traditional herbalist background where we're using, you know, lots of herbs to heal in different ways, and we're thinking about all these secondary metabolites. So when I teach about it, sometimes people are wondering how much water we use and all of these things, and by reducing the water and by kind of helping our herbs to live a very wild lifestyle, they produce extra secondary metabolites or more secondary metabolites in response to their environment, and that's a lot of the medicine we're looking for. And so that was interesting to read how much you talk about secondary metabolites in plants and just this this wisdom of the plants in themselves, and then how they use their plant exudates to talk to the soil and relate with the soil, and then the secondary metabolites into us. And it's just this whole web of relationships that when we pick them apart, they don't mean as much, but together it's just this magic that we can barely even understand the complexity of it, but it's breathtaking to witness and to be a part of.
And I think for me, the 40-some years in science and that's where I came to, is just such so much deeper of an appreciation of what a miracle the whole thing is. It's absolutely mind-boggling when you get into what you were just mentioning about the plants themselves and plant behavior and the hundreds, you know, hundreds to thousands of these secondary, so-called secondary metabolites that they produce that we've come to realize are so, so important in every kind of interaction plants have with the environments around them. I think too the research that's been done during the last 40 or 50 years on plants and plant behavior, and I think it's no stretch to say that they're conscious, they're sentient, they're interacting. Mm. They've got like 20 different senses. It's really, really amazing to get into what plants are doing. And I think we miss that historically. You know, they can't get up and walk around and so forth. And when I was first starting in this field, and we were working with the black brush, and the goats had browsed it during the winter, produces all this new growth, but the animals don't want to eat it. And then we're coming to realize, well, it's so high in tannins that the plant's producing. You know, in those early days, that whole field of chemical ecology was just really getting, really starting to blossom in huge ways. And, you know, it struck originally those compounds were called waste products of plant metabolism because people didn't know what roles they played. They, you know, they knew about energy and protein. They'd learned about that and minerals that plants are doing. But all these other compounds, nobody had a clue. So originally, waste products of plant metabolism was what they were referred to. Then came to call them secondary compounds. The primary compounds were energy, protein, minerals, and so forth. The secondary were all these other alkaloids and terpenes and phenolics. But now people would realize that, you know, they're every bit as important as energy, protein, minerals. And then, as you say, you know, for human uses, the value of those in herbal and medicinal. My wife and I, and she takes the lead role here in Innis where we live, we've got vegetable, herbal, and medicinal gardens planted all through the place. And, you know, you know as well or better than I do the value of that for human health and healing. The diversity of compounds that plants produce, it's tremendous. Rather than extract and purify to amplify effects, those diverse arrays of compounds, I think, are really etiologic in health.
I would absolutely agree. I feel like I don't even need to take them a lot of times. If I'm just working in a field of tulsi for a certain amount of time, it's just coming through my fingers, and my fingers are full of the resin, and I'm absorbing all of this. And related to your comment about plants as these sentient beings, I really don't know who's the boss out there. I kind of think that they're the boss, and I'm there for them, and they're directing me in my work every day. It's really a beautiful place to be, and it's opened my eyes to spend pretty much all of my summer hours in those fields with such diverse plants and their diverse chemical arrays that I'm smelling and touching and seeing. The color of their petals affects my mood, every little piece of it, and there's no way it can be synthesized into one thing. And so I feel very fortunate to be in that position. But I'd love to pick your brain about a couple things that you said in the book, which are just so interesting. I loved one of the sections where you're talking about how quickly the gut microbiome and the gut biology can change based on forage, and that's whether it's in animals or in humans. I thought that I know a lot about the gut microbiome, but you talked about how quickly the biology shifts based on the food. Can you speak to that a little?
Yes. You know, of course, nowadays the human microbiome is such a hot topic of research and really getting its due. It's so important. It's nice to see that. But I chuckle when I think about it, because 50, 60 years ago, that was already such a huge topic in ruminant nutrition. These ruminant animals, cattle, sheep, goats, deer, elk, all the ruminant species, both in animal nutrition and then in wildlife nutrition. People were really doing so much study of that, and so much was learned over those years. And just let you know how we just live in our own little silos, I think, in the different disciplines of science, honestly. And that's not, you know, I'm not making a critique or that, but just saying we stick to our own stuff, because if humans had been looking at what ruminant nutritionists were doing and got interested in that, it would already be a done topic, you know?
Well, and it's like cutting totally edge right now.
Right, and it's on the edge. But one of the points, you know, and so I think of these hostas in Africa, and they talk about, boy, they've got this incredibly diverse microbiome, gut microbiome. And they do, and they're saying, well, it's because they eat this huge array of different foods. And, you know, Freeland and Jansen were making that argument back in 1974 for species of wild creatures, that, you know, the more diverse arrays of plants they eat, they maintain a much more diverse gut microbiome, and that's really good for their health for a whole bunch of reasons and so forth. And then people were learning, you know, there's some terrible losses of domestic animals due to poisoning from plants back in the day. And I don't have to go into specifics of those. But in some of the cases, that was because they were moved from familiar to unfamiliar environments. and they were really hungry when they got to the unfamiliar place, and they ate plants that they'd never seen before because they were hungry and didn't have any choice, and they ended up dying. I'm thinking of halogeet, this herb called halogeet in Utah that's very high in oxalates, and pictures of just 1,000 sheep dead across the landscape. Well, what they came to understand about that was that if those sheep had been able to gradually increase their intake, which they'll do naturally if they're not forced, that would have allowed populations of bacteria that break down oxalates to build up, and it would never have been they wouldn't have lost a sheep to it, and they never did. And cattle eat that shrub too. So it's really allowing a week to 10 days for those populations to build up, and there wouldn't have been any problem. So I could tell story after story after story of really neat kind of work that was done related to the value of diversity in the diet of animals, is what that does for the microbiome, and then, you know, how the microbiome comes to adapt to the diet that's being eaten. And if you don't have certain foods in your diet, then certain bacteria their populations won't be as high, like those ones that degraded the oxalates I was just talking about. Yeah, it's an amazingly fascinating topic. I think, too, you know, you've read in the book that I talk about these metabolic feedbacks, that palatability is more than a matter of taste. It certainly involves our liking for flavor, but what we studied so much were these metabolic feedbacks that alter liking for the flavor of food as a function of our needs. So cells and organ systems are really influencing our liking, and one of those systems is the microbiome, and so people are studying that right now and saying, oh man, the microbiome through peptides and transmitters and different things are altering our liking for the flavor of food, and they're showing that. But again, and it frustrates me, what they're missing too is that so are your lungs, and so are your kidneys, and so is your brain. All these organ systems have needs, and they influence our liking. I think one of the most dramatic examples of that is with people who have organ transplants. And I'm thinking of that book by Claire Sylvia, Change of Heart.
Yes, that was such a fascinating part of your book.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
How her preferences broadened out. They didn't restrict. They broadened out to reflect the preferences of her donor, you know? And so she started to like beer and peppers and chicken nuggets and all the things that he loved. And that's heart and lungs, you know, having a say in what she's eating. And that's a really key point. We studied so much that, and, you know, I've just come to be very comfortable with those ideas. But I think back 45 years ago when we were doing the first studies of that and seeing that you could totally change liking for a food by what you put into the stomach of the animal after it ate that food. You could make them love a food or you could make them hate the food, just depending on those feedbacks.
Wow. And you talked about also in this thread about nutrition, like supplements, mineral vitamin supplements, and how those artificial supplements can trick us into thinking we have enough or too much of something and change our desires for our food and what we pick as well.
We studied so much those kind of things, how with both the primary and the secondary compounds, and we would give animals supplements. And then we would turn them out to forage on landscapes. And if the supplement was providing what they needed, they would avoid plants that had those compounds. And that same thing applied to plants that they would use to get rid of internal parasites. If we dewormed the animals, they wouldn't use so much of those plants because they didn't need it. So we were then thinking a lot, well, how much do we provide things that they might ordinarily be able to get, and then we're just causing an expense for ourselves from the domestic animal standpoint. We did so much work with livestock producers over the years, too, you know, really working one-on-one on food and habitat selection and thinking about these kind of things and many other things. But then I think a lot about, well, when we process foods, which I'm not a fan of processed foods, I'll have to say, if one thing did come across that was fairly certain reading the human literature, it's that when you extract and purify and process foods, you really set yourself up for obesity and diet-related diseases. So when we do that process, and then we enrich and fortify them with nutrients that that young children or adults might get from vegetables and fruits and stuff, it's just a double whammy.
Confuse ourselves. Fred, we are already out of time. Can you believe it? I knew that was going to happen.
Yes, I believe it.
I know, me too. I want to talk for like five more hours. So I'm going to thank you for joining us today. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Public Radio KDMK. We will see you next month on the Living Permaculture Show.